If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. On today's podcast, you'll hear an interview I recently did with the historian Janet Nelson about the medieval king Charlemagne. Janet's the author of a new biography of Charles, and we met at her home in London to discuss his remarkable life and achievements.
For listeners who might not know anything about Charlemagne or the world that he lived in, could you start by giving us a very brief primer about Charlemagne?
Yes. Well, Charlemagne was born in 748, and he lived to a ripe age for those times. To be 65, which is quite old. His father had founded a new dynasty in what you might call the centre of Europe, France and Germany. But the most important thing about his reign, I think, was that it began in quite a small area and got bigger and bigger, so that in the end most of what is now Europe, if you prefer to say like the EU, that all those territories were directly or indirectly part of his empire.
I think the name Charlemagne will be familiar to a lot of people, yeah. But you, in the book, choose to largely avoid that title and instead call him Charles. Why did you choose to do that?
I think I say this in the book, that at my mother's knee, I was taught to be very sceptical about great men. And so I didn't want to begin with the notion that greatness was a kind of foregone conclusion. I'm starting with him as when he was born. So this baby, it was not a foregone conclusion what he was going to make of his life. Looking back, of course, we know what happened. But at the time, people didn't know what happened.
Why did you want to write this biography? Why do you think that we need a new biography of Charlemagne?
It's not a conventional narrative. And because it focused so much on the family, on the dynasty, a lot about women and children and the relationships between siblings, between parents and children, between different members of the family.
How do you think that those relationships impacted on Charlemagne and his reign?
Far from being a foregone conclusion how this dynasty would work out, there were all kinds of tensions and unforeseen events, which meant that it was anything but plain sailing. Well, another theme that I wanted to bring out, apart from the dynasty, was the notion of the creation of an empire. Charlemagne himself is constantly experimenting. He's encountering new situations. He thought it would work, but he couldn't be sure.
So do you think it's this emphasis on empire building or the emphasis on personal relationships that makes this a new approach to Charlemagne?
I think both. I'm starting with dynasty because I think people underestimate that. Other historians have underestimated the importance of these very close kin-type relationships, which only by using those relationships could the regime work at all. The whole family was involved in making it work. So Charlemagne had lots of children and he marries the girls off to men he can trust. He gets his sons involved in government. He gets nephews, cousins, uncles, aunts. They're all, in some way or other, plugged into his regime.
Can we get a sense of what any of those relationships meant, not only in a political sense, but in a personal sense?
Yes, I think that it's a lot about personalities. The only way it could work is Charles trusting his own guesswork about who would be trustworthy. And on the whole, he was very good at that. He had a huge governmental apparatus and it was at different levels. But at the end of the day, the buck stopped with him. So he was very... In the end, I think he became more and more skilled at choosing his agents.
To pick up on that point a bit more, you do make a lot of effort to reconstruct or get a bit closer to his personality as well as his politics in the book. And you suggest that more of his personality can be known than first meets the eye.
Yes.
What can we discern about the personality of Charlemagne from the sources available?
All early medieval historians start with moaning about how scarce the sources are. And I think that's a fair point. On the other hand, there are a lot of sources which I would say most historians have not thought was terribly interesting. Or, well, things like about relationships between mothers and children, and between family members of various kinds. To me, these are really important things to think about. We're not just talking about politics and military matters, though those are very important, but we're also talking about members of families in a space, in a palace, in a room, in a bedroom, and what comes out of these encounters with each other. Close family members either cooperated with each other or in the end became rivals of each other. So it was this powerful ruler has three sons. Do they get on? I mean, these are the questions that that the father would be asking, say? Would they be able to work together, or would there be endemic tensions and rivalries between even these very small groups of people? And there's an awful lot of that going on in every generation. But sometimes they get along fine. Charles has these wives sequentially. Roughly speaking, you could say every 10 years, one of them would die. And that meant a lot of changes because of other kin. The wife would have her own network because of her own kin. But the next wife would be another lot of people that need to be manipulated in some way, or made use of, or not to sound too instrumental about it, but the relationship between the ruler and the people he could trust would involve a new lot of people who would be the new wife's kin.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
He would get a message, of course, and express that message in terms of the trust that he had in the person he was talking to. A sort of dialogic kind of relationship that he had, which made his government work.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Charles's reign is often cited as a high point of culture.
Yeah.
The Carolingian Renaissance.
Yeah.
What was his involvement in that? Can we see him as contributing to that or responsible for that?
I think to a very considerable extent, he is doing just that. He's creating a cultural change, a new kind of way of collaborating with people and plugging into this ancient civilization that was Rome to give it respectability, but to also to give it a common language, because Latin is what these people are operating in, and in that sense it makes it easier for them to communicate with each other. Particularly as they're trying to set up schools, which will do precisely that, using this common language was a way that brought the empire together, and the system of communications worked very much better than you might have otherwise expected.
So it sounds like he was essentially a combination between a moderniser and an innovator on the one hand, he was also took a lot of inspiration from earlier systems. Would you say that's fair?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, that he was drawing on the past, but he was also innovating. But partly by drawing in these people from different parts of what became his empire, like Spain, like Anglo-Saxon England. That was not part of the empire, and most of Spain wasn't either. But they had a lot of communications and connections. And the bits that were very much solidly part of the empire were what's now France, what's now Germany, what's now the Netherlands, what's now Italy. Even places like Hungary, like Croatia, Slovenia. These are peripheral, but they were, by the end of Charlemagne's reign, they were being incorporated.
What do you think was behind his ability to incorporate all those disparate lands into one empire? Was it this cultural assimilation and exchange, or was it his military capabilities or his administration? What do you think was behind it?
All those things. But they were also, and maybe, I mean, a lot of historians would say that this was really the dynamo that kept it going. It was religion, and it was the church, and it was then the structure of the church, which became very much a royal area of interest. It was often very local, and the system of dioceses, say, that goes back to late antiquity, Christian antiquity. But what Charles did, his father had set the way, but Charles even more so, was to embrace the church and commandeer posts for the people that he thought would do the job properly. He was very, very interested in you might almost say interfering in, managing the church. So the religious aspect of his activities wasn't just, you know, setting up this amazing capital at Aachen and building this church, which you can still go and visit. That was very much part of a centralization effort, drawing people in, sending people out again, but it was genuinely an attempt to make this a place which God had appointed Charles to construct. Charles was deeply religious. Charles was trying to commune with God, and he believed that God was directing what he was doing. And that came out in the case of these people, these peripheral peoples, like in Scandinavia, like in Hungary, the Saxons. They were pagan, and this sense of mission, conversion, that runs through the whole reign in a very powerful sort of subcurrent.
And what did that missionary zeal mean on the ground? How was it enforced? And did it mean that religion was essentially forced on people who didn't want it?
A bit of both. To start with, I think that there was a lot of violence was involved, and then there were successive periods where there was less violence, and then there would be another wave of violence emanating from Charles. Charles was very interested in what was going on in the regions at a very local level. And that's why he needed a cadre of able, generals, as it were, but I'm using that as a metaphor. You know, the people that were in charge of the government as well, people who weren't churchmen themselves, but they were required by Charles to make sure that there were parish priests around, and that there were the dioceses were being operated in the way that canon law said they should be. So the whole legal system became kind of deeply, deeply infused with Christian ways, Christian institutions, church institutions, from the most powerful ones down to parish priests who were told that they had got to make sure that babies were baptized, and they had to make sure that there were parish priests who were had schools in villages. You can guess that a lot of it didn't happen quite as Charlemagne might have dreamt, but it was, these ideas were there, and they were written down. They were put down in law books. So even long after Charles was dead, these instruments of communication, conversion, implementation, these continued to be used. So there was and to go back to what you said earlier about this sort of Carolingian Renaissance, this big cultural change, the religious elements were absolutely central. And they long outlasted Charles's reign.
So what do you think overall was the secret to his success as an empire builder?
I would say it was because, A, Charles was absolutely determined to make the system work, and he trusted a lot of people who he gave official posts to, both churchy and secular. But he was the sort of person, I think, that if you met him, his personality would be not necessarily overwhelming, but he would get a message across and express that message in terms of the trust that he had in the person he was talking to. That's how I imagine his sort of dialogic kind of relationship that he had, which made his government work.
So he was a very good manager, essentially.
Yes. Management would be a good word to use.
At the very start of this conversation, we spoke about avoiding thinking of him as a great man, but a lot of people over time have done that historically. Yes. How has Charles's legacy, well, we should probably call him Charlemagne in this respect, because that's how he's been evoked, essentially,
yes.
been used in more modern times, yes. been used as a symbol yes. By people?
I think it was a lot of... It had a lot to do with the ideology of Europe. Europe divided partly when it was part of the Holy Roman Empire. Something like that was what Napoleon was trying to create. That famous picture of him, you know, gazing at the throne. So I think there's a huge gap between what Charlemagne was doing and what was going on in the 8th and 9th centuries. And what really got started in the time of the Crusades, when the Franks believed that, they thought that Charles had gone to Jerusalem. There was, by then, there was a myth about Charles going to the Holy Land. There was a real connection in the sense that Charles was very concerned about what was happening in his own lifetime in the Holy Land, like that the churches were falling into disrepair and that Islam was not favouring the church. So he sent some agents in 808 to go to the Holy Land and write up an account, a detailed account of all the holy places and the numbers of Christian hermits and custodians of these holy places. But it was the Crusaders that got this notion that Charles had gone there. Not true. But they were in the footsteps of Charlemagne. That's how they pictured themselves. So the myth grows.
How significant was it that Charles had such a long life and a long rule?
Yeah. I came up with a little idea I think it might have been near the beginning of the book, that that there was a sort of likening of Charles to Queen Victoria. That Queen Victoria had an exceptionally long life. No monarch had ever had as long life as she did. Well, she, of course, wasn't actually in charge of running things the way that Charles was, but she was an icon, a symbol of continuity. And I think that, and then people then felt that it would always be like this, that this was a sort of stable situation and it wasn't going to collapse. The same was, it could be said of Charles, that he was, he'd always been there. There were very few people in his empire by the early, let's say the period between 800 and 814 when he died. There were very few people that could remember a time that there hadn't been Charles.
That was Janet Nelson. Janet's book, King and Emperor, A New Life of Charlemagne, is out now, published by Allen Lane. You can read my interview with her in the August issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now, and find plenty more on medieval history at our website, historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman.